This title of this class is on Lenin, Trotsky and the Russian Revolution, and it's part of a series on what is Trotskyism, which is designed to answer that question and make an argument as to why Trotskyism is the revolutionary politics of today. I'll make the argument in political and programmatic terms, not in terms of anything that resembles a cult of the personality or anything, which is an allegation, a slander that's been thrown at Trotskyism by some hostile political trends. But Trotskyism is not a personalist trend. I would argue it's a direct continuity today of politically armed Bolshevism. That's the communism that led the October Revolution in 1917, which was the world's first working class revolution, in which the proletariat seized power consciously and held onto it for a significant amount of time. The fate of the Russian Revolution, its degeneration, and the relationship of Trotskyism as a movement to that will be dealt with in later classes. In this presentation, I intend to begin to illustrate how Trotskyism represents today the communism of 1917. I just want to make clear, because there could be some misunderstanding about this, that this is not a polemic against Lenin and the Bolshevik Party. It's rather a historical explanation of how a synthesis of different trends, which are all deeply rooted in the debates and polarizations that were crucial in the period that encompasses the lead up to and the course of three revolutions in Russia, were intertwined with the 1914-18 World War and produced the trend that today is known as Trotskyism. The Russian Revolution of October 1917, in my view, was the greatest event so far in human history. And it took socialism as a goal and a movement that was implicitly present in the rise of the working class as a social force, with the industrialization in the 18th, 19th and 20th centuries, and gave it flesh and blood. In a major European country, a working class party took power by an organized insurrection. And it not only decreed that land be distributed to the peasantry, who were actually already seizing it from the landlords in any case, but it immediately decreed an end to Russian involvement in the all-European war that was going on at the time, and proceeded to attack the power of native and foreign capitalists who were driving the war and threatening the working class with starvation and death in the war. And the slogan "Bread, Peace and Land" summed up the programme of the insurrection, which was led by Lenin as the leader of the Bolshevik Party and organised by Trotsky, who had been a long-time critic, a part ally and part opponent of the Bolshevik Party, and only led his own group into the Bolsheviks after the revolution of February 1917, when women workers ignited a massive movement of workers and soldiers that spontaneously, more or less, overthrew the Tsarist regime. The revolutionary overthrow of Tsarism was long anticipated by those who claimed the banner of Marxism in Russia. It was long argued about. There's a conundrum, really, that Russia was a country that was mainly agrarian, with a huge peasantry, and the most backward major power in Europe. But the conundrum is that it had a growing militant working class that was rapidly becoming, at that time, the most advanced and political in Europe. Part of the background of this. I mean, the 1905 revolution, which is the first of the three, in some ways was the dress rehearsal, in many ways, was the dress rehearsal for 1917. And that began on the 9th of January 1905. Which was known as Bloody Sunday, when a huge demonstration of workers was actually led by a priest, went to petition the Tsar for relief from enormous suffering that they'd been experiencing under the Tsarist regime. And they were shot down in the most blatant and provocative massacre. That massacre kicked off a huge wave, an accelerating wave of mass actions, of strikes, and radicalization in general of the population. And as a result of that, 1905 saw the emergence of a new form of working class organization, which is known as a Soviet or Workers' Council. And you know, initially they were something like regional or citywide general strike committees or something like that, but they soon outgrew even that, and they became effectively alternative working class governments, at least on a local level. On a national level, you could say that the Soviets as an aggregate were the basis for an alternative working class democratic form of government. But that wasn't really to reveal its potential until 1917. And Russian social democracy was very diverse, well, quite diverse in that period. There were different, a variety of different trends. Social democracy being Marxism, not social democracy, broadly regarded as the Marxist movement, not in the sense that social democracy is today, as reformism, but it played a very important role in the Soviets. I mean, the Bolsheviks, are originally at that time had already become a distinct faction, and there was an impulse among the Bolsheviks to counterpose their own party to the Soviets, as in a sectarian manner, but that was actually corrected by Lenin. Other trends played an important role in the Soviets, including some of those who became reformists and Mensheviks, as later revealed. And Trotsky was a semi-ally of both sides, of Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, and he's a conciliator between the different factions of the Russian social democracy. But at the same time, he had a worked-out understanding of the need for a workers' government as the central point of his program. He played a very important role, a crucial role in the revolution, particularly in Petrograd, and effectively became the leader of the Petrograd Soviet in 1905, which he was later put on trial and briefly threatened with being executed when and then he was sent to Siberia after the revolution failed and the defeat of the. It's temporarily failed anyway, with the defeat of the Moscow insurrection that took place in December of that year. Various different political understandings, at least in nascent form, in embryo, were given an airing in 1905, became the basis of political differentiation and distinct tendencies, particularly in 1917 when they were put to the ultimate test. And Trotsky's little essay, which is, I've got one edition of it, there's another version of it there, it's the same thing, that little essay is titled Three Concepts of the Russian Revolution, sums it up quite well, along with the other readings that I put on the list, which was a pamphlet by Lenin called Two Tactics of Social Democracy and the Democratic Revolution, and Lenin's April Theses as well, which were, I mean, all these things make it very, very clear. The shift that took place in Lenin's thinking between the two revolutions. The position of Mensheviks is criticised quite at length by Lenin in this Two Tactics pamphlet, and demolished, really. I mean, their concept was that Russia, because it had a though Russia had a powerful working class, it was more backward than the main capitalist countries of Europe, and therefore both Lenin and the Mensheviks ruled out the possibility that the working class of Russia could come to create its own government at that time. And the Menshevik position was quite simple. It was that the backwardness of Russia meant that a bourgeois revolution was all that was possible. Therefore, a bourgeois revolution must be led by the bourgeoisie. It's a simple it's a mechanistic position that meant the working class movement had no role at all, except to come to support the capitalists, the democratic capitalists. And it could only wait for future capitalist developments passively and postpone its own demands to the indefinite future. And in the meantime, it should refrain from doing anything that would upset capitalists and make them recoil from the revolution. You see, Lenin, in his pamphlet Two Tactics, which I referred to a few minutes ago, was very scathing about this and pointed out that the bourgeoisie was incapable of leading a struggle against Tsarism. It was materially bound up with the repressive state apparatus of Tsarism, and it was prepared to combine its rule with its own, prepared to countenance a combination of its own rule with the much of the pre-capitalist structure of Tsarism. And though it had to adapt to discontent, and it would seek actively to minimise the sweep of any upheaval, you know. And basically, the bourgeoisie would prefer a deal with Tsarism to bring about gains for itself, without delivering any gains for the peasantry, and most of all, without delivering any gains for the working class. That's what we would prefer, you know. So Lenin, in his pamphlet Two Tactics, he counterposed the idea of something called the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry to the Bolsheviks' position of simply supporting the bourgeoisie. And what that concept was a revolutionary government of a class alliance with the working class and the peasantry and its political representatives. This would act as a substitute for the bourgeoisie and push through a thoroughgoing democratic revolution against the will of the bourgeoisie, delivering in the end the bourgeois regime in which democratic demands were pushed as far as they possibly could. But it's very clear from reading that pamphlet, the Two Tactics, that the Bolsheviks and Lenin were absolutely clear at that point that the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry would be a bourgeois regime in class terms, and it couldn't go beyond the democratic capitalism. To be fair to Lenin and his perspective, there is a hypothesis in there that basically says, you know, it's a bit convoluted. It says that if there was a revolution in Russia along these lines, it might trigger off a socialist revolution in the more advanced capitalist countries of Europe. And it was possible that their capitalism could be overthrown. And then as a result of that happening, maybe Russia could actually go on a social, you know, embark on a more socialist road as a result of what would happen in Western Europe. But one thing you could observe about that is it's somewhat contradictory to suppose that an explicitly non-socialist revolution in Russia would set off a socialist revolution in Europe. You know, I mean, I think it's possible that perspective of Lenin's actually reflected his own faith at that time in the in European and particularly German social democracy, which he was, you know, very closely aligned with, and you know, which at that point had not been tested as to whether it was really revolutionary or not, and obviously it proved incapable when the war broke out in 1914 of actually standing up against it, and he capitulated to imperialism and supported the war in its overwhelming majority. But anyway, I mean, irrespective of those are problems with Lenin's perspective, but it is also the case that the prolonged Bolshevik agitation and propaganda for this perspective, which was in its own way was a kind of a revolutionary perspective, created an organisation that was very cohesive and coherent, and you know, it was a combat organisation. It was completely different from the Mensheviks, who really in their support for the bourgeoisie and their general, you know, sort of amateur and non-combat practice, which reflected their purpose really. They prefigured the role of what happened to the socialist parties in Europe when they supported the war and capitulated to imperialism a few years later. See, what Lenin did by this perspective, he created a party that was not politically dependent on the bourgeoisie and which fairly uniquely was able to maintain a principal position on the world war, and thus it had the possibility of leading a workers' revolution when the opportunity arose, which it did in 1917. The contradiction was that at the beginning of this process, the Bolsheviks had developed a theoretical understanding of the Russian Revolution that said it was impossible for the Russian working class to take the initiative in instituting a socialist revolution, and hence to spread such a revolution elsewhere. And I'd argue that a resolution of this contradiction was always there, embodied in the ideas of that came from 1905 and 1906. And Trotsky, in his little book, well, it's quite a substantial book actually, called Results and Prospects. It's a long essay. He pointed out that if the working class was to take power in an alliance with the peasantry, it couldn't stop at just democracy, that it would have to use its position to defend the class interests of the workers and of the unemployed against the capitalists. And that's this is what later became known as permanent revolution, this perspective. He pointed out that in granting working, if the government came to power in this way and granted working class demands such as the 8-hour day or supported, you know, providing benefits to the unemployed and all these things, such a government would face sabotage from capitalists and would be forced to act against them and seize closed down factories to reopen them and to resume production and all these sort of things. And this was simply because the more deep going the revolution, the more hostile the bourgeoisie would be to it. As Lenin himself had noted the same thing in Two Tactics, in his pamphlet Two Tactics. And therefore the workers in power would be forced to go beyond the minimum program of the Bolsheviks and attack capitalism itself, since the material basis for a stable socialist regime did not exist in Russia. The working class in power would be forced to seek to spread the revolution to the advanced capitalist countries, to the West. And if the revolution did not spread, then the working class would inevitably later lose power in Russia one way or another. Now this is actually identical to what Lenin later put forward in the document, which is called the April Thesis, which summed up in April 1917 his own developed position that he was in favour of a working class socialist regime resting on the poorer section of the peasantry and seeking to provide political leadership to a European revolution. Basically, the coming together of Lenin and Trotsky on this, Lenin had, you know, in 1917 had to defeat considerable opposition in the Bolshevik Party itself, who'd been trained earlier in the theory of the non-socialist democratic dictatorship. And that created the basis for a revolutionary partnership that provided the political leadership of the insurrection and the seizure of power in October, when Trotsky, as in 1905, provided much of the leadership for the Petrograd Soviet, and in reality to a Russia-wide workers and soldiers and peasant movement of Soviets. It was the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Petrograd Soviet that organised the insurrection on November the 7th, which was October the 25th in our calendar, the calendar we use today, which implemented the demand for all power to the Soviets. You know. Now, I just want to talk about the differences between Trotsky and Lenin on this. Is that there is a lot of controversy, or you know, a lot has been made of the various differences between Lenin and Trotsky prior to 1917. And that Trotsky's greatest weakness before 1917 was he didn't understand or accept the need for the kind of hard faction that Lenin was building, which actually was a party in the making. And some may conclude from this that pre-1917 Trotsky's errors were of a vacillating or centrist character, that he was a bit like those, what he later said about other people who vacillate between reform and revolution, in the classic formula he uses, which is that centrists are revolutionary in words and reformist in deeds. Now, I don't think that's accurate. I reject that. And I'd say that his errors, he certainly made errors, you know, but they were on a different level of understanding of the real nature of the factions involved in Russian social democracy, not really fundamental errors of programme or perspective, purpose, or whatever you want to call it. And Trotsky looked at the positions of the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks on the revolution and noted that both of them rejected a socialist overturn and projected that Russia post-revolution would be characterized by democratic capitalism. He didn't actually see the nuances of this and the dynamic that would lead to the activist perspective of the Bolsheviks, creating a combat party that could actually carry out a revolutionary overturn. And there is some evidence that on occasions when he did actually get a glimpse of this, he suspected Lenin of being a demagogue with dictatorial ambitions, not in the sense of the dictatorship of the proletariat, but being a bourgeois demagogue and seeking power for himself in that sense, you know. I think his incorrect evaluation of the Bolsheviks was actually proved wrong in practice when Lenin himself independently broke from the democratic dictatorship perspective. And that was only after the February Revolution and the impact of a mass movement and the creation of a government that's in a somewhat slightly different way embodied the aspects of the what Lenin called the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry. But at the same time, was basically an imperialist government or a capitalist government that was a snare and a deception and was maintaining the status quo. Lenin's position was arrived at independently, but it was identical to Trotsky's, to the position that Trotsky had put forward in 1905. I mean, what really created the ability to lead the revolution was a combination of the party and that perspective, you know, the subjective will to seize power actually obviously comes from the idea that it's actually possible to do so, you know. And that's what Trotskyism is. I mean, Trotskyism is a more... is Trotsky... Lenin actually never really theorised and generalised the lessons of the April thesis. Trotsky actually has done a lot... You know, Trotsky's writings, you find a lot more of the, you know, generalisation of the role of permanent revolution and the need for the working class to solve democratic questions and questions that involve, you know, pre-capitalist relations of production in various parts of the world were first given an airing in the Russian Revolution. And that's what permanent revolution is, you know, for Trotskyists. But basically, I think, you know, that in reality, Trotskyism and Leninism, Trotskyism and Leninism in the programmatic sense, and certainly after the with the April thesis, are identical, you know. So I mean, I'll conclude there because I mean, there's a lot more material to cover if we're going to do a series of educationals on this, you know, and to explain the specifics of why Trotskyism is identical to Leninism in programmatic terms and is a revolutionary Marxism of today. But hopefully, that provides a starting point anyway for the discussion and. We can carry on with this and go to discussion.
All right, a lot there, isn't it?
I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I liked it. It kind of whet the appetite.
One thing I would add to it is that what was it that prepared the change in Lenin from the what was the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry to the April thesis. And in my view, that was the development of his internationalist outlook. In 1915, Nikolai Bukharin wrote a book on world imperialism, right? And it was the first real serious analysis of the state of imperialism throughout the world, and Lenin was so impressed with that book that he wrote the foreword to it himself, and then subsequent to that in 1916 he wrote Imperialism: The Highest Stage of Capitalism, which is if you like, in a lot of ways, a popular version of Bukharin's work, and it's more it's in some ways less academic and it's more popularly pitched, but Bucharin's work was the serious work, and once those two works were, if you like, in the canon of the Bolsheviks, that then prepared the April thesis, because then he understood that the Russian Revolution then was not simply a revolution in Russia, that it was part of a world revolution, or part of the possibility of a world revolution, and that following on from that, that the consciousness of workers actually were not just a national consciousness, but they were now an international consciousness. They knew what happened to workers in other countries. They were informed about what was happening. And every victory of a worker in one place encouraged the workers in another state, and every defeat drew them back. So that real internationalism of those two works was what prepared the ground, and also it does explain why Lenin had a very, very soft spot for Bucharin, although Bucharin made several errors later. He was sort of ultra left and things, and at a certain point. But Lenin never lost his softness for him, because he had, if you like, shown him the way forward at a certain point, and he was grateful, very grateful to him for doing that. Mm-hmm. So that's the point I make about that that period.
No, that's helpful, and you know, I'll play that back several times, and because that sounded more like something that was happening now.
Yeah.
I could identify with that, but I can't identify with what's happening with Jeremy Corbyn.
Come on, do you want to go with Jeremy Corbyn?
Because I don't understand what is going on there, because I don't see him as being any way similar to, you know, the talk of revolution. Yeah, I don't see him as being anything akin to what you were just speaking
any
of.
Any of those people, of course.
No.
Of course he isn't. No.
But he professes that he is. I mean, and people who he likes to give the idea to people that this is going to be a big thing, and da-da-da-da. He's going to lie down and have his tummy tickled like the rest of them. I think so.
But the question is not Corbyn as such, but it's the movement that has risen him to the top. Nobody was more surprised than he was to be elected the leader of the Labour Party the first time.
Yeah.
He never saw that coming. Graham Durham will recount to you the meeting that happened just a couple of hundred yards from here. What wasn't it when they all came together and John McDonnell was there and all that, and the leadership election was coming up. And it was primarily, I have to say, it was me and Graham Durham strongly argued, we must have a left candidate, we must have a left candidate. And John McDonnell was there, and John McDonnell, I'm too old now, you say, I've done it too many times, it's no good, I can't do it. But even if you can't do it, we must have one of them, at least we must try it out. And then, I don't want to fucking blow it up that we were, at least we were part of a movement that pressured him into it.
Right, right.
And then when he got projected into it, he suddenly discovered to his absolute amazement how popular he was with the membership of the Labour Party. Yeah, yeah. And then Of course, he was popular with the Labour Party membership, but ah, you're completely unelectable, aren't you? Nobody will vote for you. And I'm not alone, but they will vote for him. So the movement is there. He has no revolutionary politics. He's no revolutionary politics at all. So he's a pacifist.
Yeah.
He's a very weak man himself politically, but.
So what, he's going to hand over the mantle for somebody else?
I don't know. I put it another way. I would say it's like old Chairman Mao. I don't often quote Chairman Mao, but Chairman Mao used to say about the sea for the fish to swim in. The movement does provide the sea for the revolutionary fish to swim in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Thatcher, when she imposed her counter-revolution and her neoliberal agenda, you know, that cut the guts not only out of the left wing of the Labour Party, but it went right through down to the smallest left wing group. You know, it cut the legs from under them because there wasn't a leftist agenda there, even at the reformist level. You know, they used to be quite a substantial section of the British Labour Party that thought you would get a socialist government through Parliament, and you'd vote it in, and they'd enact socialist legislation, and then you'd have socialism. Suddenly, there was very few of those people. She had killed off all those people, and she killed off the youth. But now, I think what the Corbyn government or the Corbyn leadership will do is it will open up the possibility for genuine revolutionaries to operate once more. It will give us an audience, but of itself, you are right, it will not produce anything.
I think it's a matter of British conditions, isn't it? I mean, Britain is very different from Russia in 1917. Or even 1905 or whatever, you know, it's an advanced country, it's been very wealthy at times, and it's lost a lot of its power. And at a certain point in the 70s, you had a very strong social democracy and a strong trade union movement and all this sort of thing, but the ruling class decided that it couldn't tolerate it because profit rates were going down, and they needed, you know, they had this project, not just in Britain, but internationally, reviving capitalism, which had become somewhat, you know, moribund and less profitable, by a conservative offensive against the working class and defeating reformist parties and humiliating them and replacing them with parties that really endorse the boss's agenda in economic terms, in things like free market economics and whatever. And there was a sort of a counter-revolution against social democracy. There's nothing revolutionary about social democracy, but you can have a counter-revolution against the non-revolutionary movement, you know, something to make things qualitatively worse. And that's what happened that's what happened not just here in America, and to a lesser extent in Europe. It's never been completely consummated in Europe, in places like France, though who knows what Macron might do, you know. But this counter-revolution against social democracy, it's lasted for 40-odd years, you know. But I think what Corbyn represents is not anything really... He has a revolutionary potential, but he himself... I mean, in some level, he is quite principled within his own framework, you know. I mean, he's been around a small minority of isolated anti-war activists, people like him. There's several people, McDonald, there's Tony Benn in the old days, and, Dennis Skinner, who's still a remnant around, as Galloway as well.
And so I like him.
Yeah, so do I. In some ways, I do. Yeah, he's a scoundrel as well. But
I like him better.
He has some oomph, I know that. You know, he's got more. He really has some.
Gives it a bit of a go.
He's got bottle, you know.
Yeah.
He's flawed, though. You know, sometimes he fights for the wrong things, you know. But then I suppose they all do. These people are quite principled in their own framework, you know, but they're not revolutionary. But, you know, in order to fight, you know, what they've become, you know, revolutionaries are still a small minority. and became a very small minority of a left-wing minority of the left-wing minority in the period of neoliberalism. And it's not that surprising that a slightly more mainstream left-wing figure like Corbyn, who was one of the leaders of the Iraq War movement and things like this, has come to the fore and being the means at which has sort of struck a big blow in the opposite direction at last, after 40 years. So, no, it's not the same as 1917, but it is something that we have to, that we have to understand is a positive development. It moves things back in our direction, back in the direction of socialists.
And I saw him in Watford, and it has got very polished now. It's good to watch him.
Not
on the TV, to be where he is and watch around at the people, the way they're taking it on and the way they're discussing
And it is becoming a real mass thing as well. This Jeremy Corbyn chapter is going on everywhere. You know, it's becoming really quite frightened of it, actually.
But he won't be able to deliver, will he?
He won't, no.
No, he won't be able to deliver it.
But when you raise expectations,
then you raise anger.
And then the possibility of the mass movement begins to consolidate in terms of strikes and things like that.
It's not pretty certain that he will not deliver anything as well. I mean, if he gets elected with a big majority and then there's a movement behind him, can push him into doing things, and delivering something. And then when he betrays, some future point, or when it comes to a stop, people want to go further. There's all sorts of possibilities. I mean, maybe it will end up in a disaster like in Greece. Mm-hmm. But it could end up with something slightly better than that. I don't know. It's very difficult to predict, what might happen. But, it's down to us to some extent.